Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I am Adam Leshinsky, Senior Editor-at-Large at Fortune Magazine, and your moderator for today's program. It is now my pleasure to introduce today's guest, the 75th United States Secretary of the Treasury, Timothy Geithner. Secretary Geithner, who is 50 years old, brings to the Treasury Department a unique collection of experiences and accomplishments that are particularly germane to his subject matter at hand today. As a child, he lived in present-day Zimbabwe, Zambia, India, and Thailand, where his father worked for the Ford Foundation. In pursuit of undergraduate degrees in government and Asian studies from Dartmouth and a master's degree in international economics and East Asian studies from Johns Hopkins, he lived in China and studied Chinese and Japanese. In a career devoted mostly to public service, Secretary Geithner has worked for the International Monetary Fund and at the Treasury Department, including a stint as an attaché in the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo. From 1993 to 2009, he was president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. He was sworn in as the Obama administration's Treasury Secretary on January 26, 2009. Please join me in welcoming to San Francisco Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner.
Thank you, Adam. Thanks for having me. Nice to see you all. It's good to be out of Washington. Makes you more optimistic to be about the country when you're out of Washington. And it's nice to be back in California. And my compliments to the Commonwealth Club. You know, you're engaged in the noble, important purpose of raising the quality of public debate about economic policy. And we face some tough choices as a country going forward. And we'll make better choices as a country if we can successfully raise the quality of public debate. Now, 3 years ago, President Obama laid out a broad strategy for rebuilding the American economy. He recognized then, as I'm sure all of you do, that we live in a global economy. And this global economy will be a source of growth for the United States, but also a source of challenges. The president understood that to confront the global financial crisis, we had to work to support growth around the world, not just focus on putting out the financial fires in the United States. And he recognized that American workers and American businesses faced more intense competition from countries around the world. He understood that to build a foundation for stronger growth in the United States, we could no longer borrow lavishly from the rest of the world to finance an economy driven by consumption and by housing. Future growth would have to come more from investment and from exports, and we would have to return to living within our means. The president acted to put in place a very powerful and very effective strategy for rescuing the American economy from a broken financial system, from the crisis. And as a result of those policies and those of the Fed, the American economy went from shrinking at an annual rate of 9% a year in the fourth quarter of 2008 to positive growth in the summer of 2009. And we helped pull the world economy back from the brink of a global depression. And the early years of recovery have been led by investment and by exports. Now, in 2010 and 2011, as the engine of the American economy was starting to work again, we were hit by the European crisis, by Japan's crisis, and by higher oil prices, and economic growth slowed. Powerful reminders of the ways in which events beyond our borders can affect how fast we grow. But parts of the world, particularly emerging market economies, have been a great source of strength for the United States since the crisis. China has been a significant part of this growth. Overall, American exports have increased about 34% since 2009. American workers and American companies are becoming more productive. Productivity growth is up. we're becoming more competitive, and this growth has been supported by rapid increases in private investment financed by a recovering financial system. Next week, the Secretary of State and I travel to China for the fourth round of the U.S.-China Strategic and Economic Dialogue, and no other country presents China's particular mix of opportunities and challenges for the United States. I want to talk about those opportunities and challenges, but I want to start with a few fundamental propositions about our economic relationship. First, this relationship provides significant benefits to both our two nations. Even though we compete in many areas, our economic strengths are largely complementary. Second, China faces a very complicated, very daunting, formidable set of challenges itself as it transitions to a more open market economy with a more modern financial system and faces rising costs, a slowing labor force, and productivity growth. Third, our economic priorities with China, from its exchange rate to its treatment of intellectual property, reflect changes that are fundamentally in China's interests and essential for sustainable economic growth in China. And finally, important to recognize that the prosperity of Americans depends importantly on the economic policies we pursue here in the United States. And even as we work to encourage further reforms in China, we need to understand that our strength as a nation will depend not on choices made by China's leaders, but on the choices we make here at home. Now, we focused our economic policy towards China on achieving two broad strategic objectives. The first is to expand opportunities for U.S. companies to export and sell to China, to level the competitive playing field, to encourage economic reforms that would move China away from its export-oriented growth model and extensive subsidies for Chinese companies. Our second objective has been to deepen our cooperation with China on a range of international economic and financial issues so that we're better able to work together on common global challenges like the financial crisis of 2008 and the ongoing European crisis. We want to build a stronger framework for economic cooperation for the future that will allow us to balance the interests of what are today and will be for the foreseeable future the two largest economies in the world. Now, we've made significant progress in these objectives over the past 3 years. Since early 2009, U.S. exports to China have almost doubled, growing twice as fast as our exports to the rest of the world. China has taken steps to improve protection and enforcement of U.S. intellectual property rights. China has opened up new sectors to foreign firms in insurance and finance. China has cut some tariffs and launched a pilot program to reduce taxes on services, which we hope will be part of a broader program of reduction in tariffs and taxes, which today can make the price of consumer products in Shanghai twice what they are here in San Francisco. China's exchange rate has appreciated and is up about 13% against the dollar in real terms since June 2010, about 40% since 2005. China's also announced recently that it's going to widen the band to allow market forces to play a greater role in setting the exchange rate's value. And it's continuing to remove controls on the movements of capital into and out of China. And China's trade surplus has fallen to less than 3% of GDP last year, from about 8% when the president took office in 2009. Now, despite this important progress, we have unfinished business and new challenges ahead. Looking forward, in addition to our longstanding concerns with the piracy of U.S. intellectual property, with government procurement preferences for Chinese companies, with taxes and tariffs and other limitations on market access, there are several Chinese reforms ahead that are particularly important to the United States. First, China's financial system is still dominated by large state-owned banks, and this system still has comprehensive controls on deposit interest rates. This system limits the returns to household savers to below the rate of inflation, forcing them to save more, to save excessively, to achieve their financial goals and to insure against life's risks. And this limits consumption, but it also starves many Chinese companies and firms of capital, despite very, very high levels of domestic savings. To promote a more efficient financial sector, more modern financial sector, more efficient allocation of resources, interest rates will need to better reflect market forces. Raising the ceiling on interest rates and deposit rates in China will allow Chinese households to earn a higher return on their savings, increasing their income, reducing their need to save, increasing their ability to consume the goods and services of the world, including from the United States. And financial reform will help reduce one of the main advantages China's state-owned enterprises enjoy today in competing with U.S. companies. Now, these state-owned firms still compete with a range of unfair advantages in China and in the global markets. They have privileged access to cheap land and resources in addition to favorable access to credit, and they monopolize many of the most important sectors in China, including oil and telecommunications. Channeling resources into these large state enterprises, while many of China's small and medium-sized enterprises are starved for capital, ultimately hurts the Chinese economy, but it also hurts U.S. companies and workers who compete with Chinese companies. If China's state-owned enterprises want to be treated like commercial enterprises by the rest of the world, then they need to act more like commercial enterprises and rely less on this extensive set of special preferences and subsidies. Finally, while we very much welcome the reforms to China's exchange rate system, this process of correcting the existing misalignment of the Chinese currency remains incomplete, and the Chinese currency needs to appreciate further against the dollar and the other major currencies. A stronger, more market-oriented renminbi, Chinese currency, will help reinforce China's reform objectives of moving towards higher value-added production, reforming its financial system, and encouraging stronger domestic demand growth. It'll provide China the independence and the flexibility it needs to use monetary policy to respond to future changes in growth and inflation. And it'll help the world economy by reducing a source of unfair competition with China's trading partners. Now, as we've worked to advance these reforms in China, we have been very forceful in protecting American companies from unfair competition. Since 2009, the Department of Commerce has issued a total of 36 anti-dumping and countervailing duty orders on unfairly traded imports from China. The President has used the Section 421 safeguards remedy for the first time ever to protect the U.S. tire industry from a harmful surge in Chinese imports. We've successfully challenged China in the WTO, including most recently on Chinese export restraints on raw materials, limitations on the distribution of film and other media, and subsidies benefiting its domestic wind power sector. And the President recently announced the creation of an interagency trade enforcement center to enable us to more aggressively challenge foreign unfair trade practices, including by China. We've been aggressive in protecting our interests, and we will continue to do so. Now, these are our main objectives and concerns with China on the economic front. China, of course, wants certain things from the United States. China wants greater access to U.S. technology. It wants to be able to invest more in the United States. It wants to continue to have access to our market, and it would like to be accorded the same terms of access as exports from countries that we today consider market economies. And we're willing to continue to make progress on these issues, but our ability to do so will depend in part on how much progress we see from China on issues that are important to us. Now, I want to conclude by emphasizing, as I did at the beginning, that the solutions to our challenges in the United States rest first and foremost in the policies of Washington, not of Beijing. Fundamentally, how many jobs we create in the United States, how rapid incomes grow, how broad-based the gains in income are for the United States in the future will be the result of choices we make here in the United States, not the choices of others. In our efforts to rebuild the economy, repair the damage from the crisis, put more Americans back to work, we have to make sure that we're also investing in reforms that will make us more competitive and stronger in the future. As countries like China and India and Brazil and other emerging economies grow and expand, we want to see a very substantial part of that growth in demand met by goods and services that are created and produced in the United States. And if we're successful in doing that, we will be stronger as a country. But to be successful in doing that, there are things we have to do here. We have to invest in education, in innovation, in public infrastructure, and we have to improve the incentives for private investment here in the United States. These investments and reforms have to come as part of a carefully balanced package of long-term fiscal reforms to restore fiscal sustainability. These are our challenges in the United States. And they're not just an economic imperative. They're a national security imperative. Our strength as a country depends on the ability of our political system to move quickly enough to put in place solutions to these long-term economic challenges here in the United States. Our great strength as a country remain our openness to ideas and to talent, our capacity to innovate, our excellence in higher education, a willingness to invest public resources strategically in scientific research and discovery, and in the political will, the capacity of our political system to confront challenges with wisdom and with force. China's economic rise offers us the opportunity of dramatic growth and demand for things that Americans create and produce. We should welcome both the opportunity and the challenge with China. Thank you.
Quiet, we'll start our conversation. I'm sure it will be shortly.
Thank you. I may, in fact, read her question.
It's a good question.
In this pile right here.
It's a good question. Lots of people ask that question, and you could start with the question if you want, Adam.
I couldn't hear it as well as you did. You have better ears for that sort of thing. What are you going to do about was what I heard.
Well, the basic question was, and I think this is the dominant question about many of the choices we made over the last 3 years, is why did we do what we did to rescue the economy from a broken financial system? Why was that fair? Why was that necessary? And why are we still living with the scars of this crisis? And it's a basic tragic reality, unavoidable reality in financial crises, that to protect the innocent victims from a financial crisis, again, to rescue an economy from the perils of a collapsing financial system, you have to do terrible things. You have to do things you'd never want to do. You have to do things that are deeply politically difficult and will be unpopular. But if you don't do them, you leave the country terribly worse off. And if you look at the history of financial crises, you can see a powerful example of what happens when you don't have leaders like the president to make those tough choices early. Because if you look at the history of crises, you'll find that not just in the Great Depression, but in most of the history of financial crises in major economies the last 60 years or so, what made them terrible was that governments, political leaders confronting the terrible politics around rescuing a financial system caused them to wait, to hesitate, to act more slowly, hope it'll burn itself out, hope they don't have to do some tough things, and they wait too long. And the thing burns, and it gets much more expensive, much more difficult to fix. But when you act like the president did, and you decide to move more forcefully to put out the fires, you have to accept the political costs that come with that, but you have to recognize that the long-term benefits to the economy are much greater, and that without those actions, you're not going to get an economy growing again and recovering again, and nothing's possible without that. And we were very lucky we had a president willing to make those choices.
So to paraphrase, to have saved an institution that she and others might consider to be unsavory, having committed mistakes, et cetera, is preferable to a larger conflagration.
Remember, we didn't do it for the banks. We did it for the economy. We did it for the innocent victims who were suffering so much and faced, of course, the loss of tremendous value in their savings, the risk that their savings in banks would evaporate, the risk that more businesses would fail, more homeowners would face foreclosure, wouldn't be able to borrow in that context. That's why we acted. And we were, I know it's not recognized, but we were very tough on the financial system. We put in place very tough reforms, and if you question that, look how much resources the financial system is putting into fighting those reforms today.
So I want you to keep in mind your comments about making difficult decisions in a political environment for when we get to the conversation about the maybe sub-crisis that we're facing now, not of the order of 2008-2009, but we're facing that. As I look through this wad of questions that I have, and by the way, when I ask you a truly impertinent question, it's coming from here, not from me. Relatively few of them are about, most of them are about the United States, but let's take a moment and play off of the comments that you made because you're on your way to China. And I will start with a question from the audience, which is, why does the United States believe it has the right to tell China how to value its currency?
Excellent question. The global economy, for it to work, requires that the countries that compete in that economy agree to play by a set of basic rules and safeguards. Those provide a balance of benefits and obligations on countries. And a critical part of making this system work is the countries not act to artificially weaken or suppress the value of the currencies, because if they do that successfully over time, then that hurts the interests of its trading partners. So absolutely we have the right to encourage China to move on these things. Of course, China's moving not just because it's important to us. It's moving because they recognize it's in their interest. And they can't successfully manage the challenges China faces if they tie their monetary policy to the Fed's. And when you link your currency to the dollar, that's what you do. In effect, you're letting the United States make decisions about the basic stance of monetary policy in your country. So they've recognized that's not in China's interests, and they have to weaken that link, let the exchange rate play a greater role, and let the market play a greater role in setting the value of the exchange rate. And they've got some ways to go, but absolutely we have the right to take a view on that, as do China's other trading partners.
It seems, though, that no matter how much we encourage or cajole or implore and so on with the Chinese, the Chinese, at the end of the day, do what they choose to do according to their own schedule.
Like do we. You know, nations act in their interests. We act in what's in our interest, and they have to act in what's their interest, and we have to figure out a way to make those interests more compatible. But China is moving. You know, again, you can recognize that we've got a long way to go. There's just an early process of dismantling what's still an overwhelmingly state-dominated economy, but they're making changes that are fundamentally good for the United States, and it's very much our interest to work with the grain of those reforms.
Toward the end of your comments, you made reference to a handful of things that we want from the Chinese. But what leverage do we have over the Chinese?
Well, we have the reality, and I ended with this by saying, you know, China cares very much about getting more access to U.S. technology, U.S. investment opportunities, access to our market, and they want to benefit from this open trading system, which has been a huge source of growth for China. Remember, it's worth noting that China's growth over the last 3.5 decades has been substantially because of the reforms that Deng Xiaoping put in place in China 30 years ago, but also because they were able to take advantage of an open global economy that we created in the aftermath of World War II. And that open global economy with access to our markets has been a big source of growth to China, and they want to make sure they can preserve that, and that gives us some capacity to try to influence the direction of the choices they make.
Is it too simplistic to say we certainly have stopped the Chinese from acquiring technology that we don't want them to acquire, but their ability to invest seems to be unimpeded? They can invest whatever they want in the United States and do.
Subject to the safeguards we have in place to protect national security. We have a set of protections around that which we're going to maintain. But you're right to say they have the opportunity now to invest in the United States, and that's in our interest that they do so. But yeah, this is important to...
Would you dwell on that for just a moment? It's in our interests that they do so. I think it's an important point that is too often overlooked.
Well, what's a good example of this? I a few months ago, I visited a Siemens factory in North Carolina. I think it was North Carolina. And and they're investing in the United States in building power turbines and generators, very heavy things. And they're doing it because they want to take advantage of what's still the most competitive workforce in the world, and they have closer access to our markets. And they're exporting from that plant to countries around the world. And what's happening, if you listen carefully, is that the competitive playing field now is shifting more in the direction of the United States, not just because China's exchange rate is rising, but because their labor costs are rising. Companies are looking at the future, and they're seeing it's more competitive, more economically sensible to bring back manufacturing. And that's a good thing. So we want to make sure that we're encouraging that, working with the grain with that, encouraging investments by U.S. companies in the United States, but also by foreign companies.
Thank you. The Chinese have a handful of euphemisms. You mentioned one, the Indigenous Innovation Accreditation System. They basically have a system where they've decided by government fiat who will be allowed to compete in the Chinese market,
well,
who will not be.
They threatened to do that. They contemplated setting up a system where for Chinese governments that are buying things, you had to be on a list to be eligible to buy, and the only technology that was going to be on the list would be Chinese technology. And we thought that would be a threat to our interests economically, and we talked them out of doing it and got them to dial it back, wind it back.
And yet they at a higher level, they're successful in keeping certain companies or certain industries out. So of interest to this audience, they have been successful for practical purposes at keeping Facebook and Twitter out, for example, because they've decided that Facebook and Twitter should not dominate China the way they've dominated other markets.
Well, they've got other motives, too, in that context. You know, China still, they have a rather different political system from the United States. and that may be the major motive behind that particular policy.
You think that political considerations are more important in that sense than the viability of, you know, new multi-billion dollar businesses?
Maybe. I'm sure it's a mix of both things.
I had one more question from China. The question is, or about China, what do you believe is the most important factor of the U.S.-China economic relationship?
Well, let me answer that this way. I think when people look at China today, much of the debate implies or perceives China as a huge source of challenge and economic threat to the United States. I think most people dramatically overstate the strengths we see in China today. And as you think about this, remember that we're dramatically more productive than the Chinese economy is. And the challenges they face looking forward are really, really tough. You know, they have a labor force that's going to stop growing relatively soon, terrible demographics, rising costs for labor, but across the economy as the exchange rate appreciates. And they're still living with an economic structure dominated by the state and a completely state-run financial system. Those are not viable things for a country that hopes to grow sustainably over time. So I think the most important thing for people to understand about China is that what looks strong in China is not as strong as it seems. And also, of course, as I said several times in my remarks, remember that what matters to this country, how well we do, is not going to depend mostly on the choices China makes. It's going to depend mostly on what you get out of Washington in terms of better choices, better policy for this country.
I want to turn briefly to Europe. The United States recently declined to contribute to the latest firewall fund planned in Europe. Can you explain why?
Excellent question. We are doing what only the U.S. can do, we can uniquely do, and what is really very valuable to Europe as they try to manage this financial crisis, which is the Federal Reserve is doing as it did in 08 and 09, providing the European Central Bank with access to dollars through what are called swap lines. Those are tremendously beneficial to Europe as they try to reduce the risks that these financial tensions hurt growth in Europe. Only we can do that. We're doing it now, not just promising to do it in the future. Now, what the IMF decided to do was to help make sure it had the resources to cushion the potential impact on the rest of the world from China, from Europe's crisis. It went out and raised a significant amount of bilateral loans, so they had a stronger financial capacity to adjust. Now, they're already sitting on $400 billion of loanable resources. And though while we welcomed the contributions other countries made to the IMF, we didn't feel it was necessary or appropriate for us to go to Congress now in this environment and ask Congress to authorize a larger U.S. contribution. Europe has the capacity to manage this. Europe's a very rich continent. They have the financial resources to manage this. And we want to make sure the world understands that the principal financial burden for managing Europe's crisis is going to have to fall on the Europeans. We can help. We're happy to have the IMF help, but only in a supplemental capacity, not as a substitute for a more forceful European response.
And when you say that it would have been inappropriate to go to Congress in this political climate, is
not necessary. And generally, we don't do things that are not necessary.
And is Is that a euphemism for you don't think you could have gotten this through Congress if you had asked?
Well, I don't know if you've noticed, but Congress is having a hard time doing things that are overwhelmingly popular. And we don't want to... We don't want to distract them from doing things that are important to the United States.
And a slightly more substantive take on that is it given your substantive comments about Europe being able to take care of itself, our own difficulties politically?
Well, I didn't say that. I said this is something Europe can manage. We can help. We're helping in ways that are very powerful, very important. And we're happy to see the IMF play a larger role in Europe going forward. And it's good that the IMF's been able to demonstrate, as it did in 2009, that it can raise money very quickly, very substantially, as a bit of a precautionary mechanism against the risky, uncertain world we live in.
Should we be embarrassed, however, that Japan, Saudi Arabia, South Korea, Australia, and Singapore, not a European country among them, did contribute and we did not?
No, again, it's a mistake to believe that we've decided to hold back from this, decide not to contribute. We've been contributing in ways that are economically identical to countries lending to the IMF. Mm-hmm. In fact, they're more valuable to Europe today because these swap lines the Fed's extended gives them access to dollar funding they could not get from anywhere else. And that's something that is more powerful and more valuable and more effective now. Only we can do it. IMF can't help on that front. So it's not right to say that we've chosen not to participate, not to contribute. In fact, by some measures, the scale of the contributions we're making are much more direct. Remember, when a country lends money to the IMF, it's not like a noble, selfless act, or it's not like a noble act of taking a huge amount of risk. They're lending to the IMF, and in some sense, their loans are backed by the United States.
So let's turn our attention to the United States. We have an event coming on January 1st, 2013 that has been sensationally called Taxmageddon, less sensationally called the fiscal cliff. Would rather than relying on my facts, would you first just briefly explain what this Taxmageddon situation is, and then I will ask you now, what exactly is our game plan to deal with it?
At the end of this year, what people call the Bush tax cuts expire, and if Congress fails to act, instead of automatic spending cuts, some people call the sequester, goes into effect. And the combined size of those tax increases and spending cuts are quite substantial. They're about 3.5% of GDP. That gives the Congress a pretty powerful incentive to replace those expiring tax cuts and those automatic spending cuts with a set of sensible reforms that you could phase in more gradually to help bring gravity back to our fiscal position. So that's our strategy. Our strategy is to build on the framework that President's laid out, which is a balanced framework of tax reforms and spending savings, and to convince Congress to replace Taxmageddon and the fiscal cliff with a more sensible, balanced set of reforms.
And so if you would take it a step further mechanically, since we're a crowd of non-Washingtonians, how exactly does that work? When is the legislation offered? What time frame could it pass in? And what if, in the unlikely event that you can't get that done in 2 months, then what happens?
Well, it wouldn't be good.
That's a technical expression, right?
Well, we've been spending quite a lot of time with the Republicans over the past year in particular, trying to lay a foundation for a sensible resolution to these fiscal problems. We spent a lot of time last summer, and although it was very messy and very ugly, and the threats of default that the Republicans put on the country were really very damaging to confidence, we have done some important basic work in laying out a framework for tax reform and some savings on Medicare, Medicaid that we think are pretty sensible for the country. Now, they haven't been willing to join us in that yet. But I think the basic reality, the basic fiscal math facing the country is going to force them to that point because, and this is what it's at issue, what separates us now, lots of things separate us, but what separates now is that we think the only sensible way economically and politically to restore fiscal balance is through a balanced set of tax reforms and spending savings, tax reforms that only affect the top 2% of American earners. Republicans to date have been unwilling to contemplate raising any revenue through tax reform, and therefore they would put the entire burden of restoring fiscal balance on basic benefits and government functions that are very important to the country. Their plan, because they don't use any revenues, forces them to propose deep cuts in the safety net and significant cuts in benefits to retirees, as well as terribly deep cuts in basic things like education, infrastructure, which are so important to our capacity to grow going forward. And we think, confronted with that reality, they'll ultimately decide what's sensible, which is that to make progress in these long-term fiscal reforms, you've got to come with some balance.
From a mechanical perspective, would I be correct in assuming that essentially the plan assumes nothing happens before November, before the presidential election?
Except that we've been doing a lot of tough foundation laying in terms of laying out the basic choices, and the President of the United States, as you know, is spending a lot of time to explain to the country why we think you need a strategy that has this balance and it creates some room for us to invest and grow, protects Medicare for retirees, doesn't eat deeply into the critical core seed capital investments like education. And, you know, that's why we're having such an important debate.
But is the assumption that we as a country will turn to this after the election and then accomplish what needs to be accomplished by January 1st?
Yeah, now you don't need to solve all the problems for the country over the next 100 years in the 6 weeks after the election. What you have to do is to make sure you put in place a framework that makes some progress in these changes and sets up a process that allows tax reform to happen and these broader spending savings to actually be designed sensibly. So you can do it in the stages, and you don't need to try to solve everything in that moment. You have to, just to make some progress, solve the important things. And if you do that, you can replace this sequester, and you can make sure Americans understand that there's no reason why, for 98% of Americans, you need to see a significant any change in your effective tax burden.
This would amount to what critics refer to as kicking the can down the road.
No.
If we replace the sequester but don't do...
No,
you can't do comprehensive tax reform in 2 months.
No, that's right. That's exactly right. But what you can do is you can do a significant set of upfront tax changes and spending cuts, put those in place. It's easy to do that in a way that's substantial relative to the size of the sequester, but you don't want to stop there. What you want to do is put that in place and then set in motion a process to allow tax reform to come alongside some sensible long-term savings to make Medicare or Medicaid more sustainable.
And to put all of this in context, you recently said, referring to the fiscal cliff, it's not the most urgent challenge we face.
No, I didn't say that. I said that but thank you for asking it that way. That was a reference to our long-term fiscal position. You know, our deficits are unsustainable, and our long-term commitments on Medicare, Medicaid are unsustainable. But it is not the only challenge we face as a country. And you cannot use that challenge as an excuse to do nothing for the economy now. And you can't use it as an excuse to gut and undermine basic investments in education, infrastructure that we very much depend on to grow in the future. So the reason I said is recognize that, I mean, people understand this. I mean, look at the economy today. It's a tough economy still. You know, we need to get more people back to work. We have to rebuild a broken infrastructure. We have to give Americans better access to a better education. We have to make sure we're preserving government support for investments in basic science and research. We have to make sure that we preserve these tough financial reforms we put in place to protect the economy. The challenges facing the country cannot be reduced to these important long-term challenges about fiscal sustainability.
You didn't raise this, but would you argue that if it to reduce the discussion to a simplistic one of austerity versus non-austerity, that the double dip recession in the UK is an example of the wrong way to do things?
I agree that one of the things that separates us a lot from the president's opponents now is that we're saying that as you put in place these fiscal reforms, you want to phase them in gradually so the economy has a chance to recover. If you do them precipitously, if you put, you know, severe austerity in place up front, then you're going to set back the process of repair, hurt growth, unemployment will rise, the economy will be weakened, and you'll ultimately hurt the long-term path, the prospects for fiscal sustainability. So absolutely, one thing that separates these competing strategies is we want to bring a more balanced, more gradual path to restoring fiscal balance, not do it precipitously. So what matters is how you do it, how quickly you do it, how successful you are in preserving room for key investments, protecting the most vulnerable, preserving the safety net. Those things matter a lot. And you don't want to use the long-term concerns, however justified, about fiscal sustainability to put in place severe austerity that would push us back into a much weaker, dangerous economic situation.
You're saying that increasing austerity would raise the risk of another recession. And would I be correct in assuming that your analysis of the Republican position is they want more austerity? Therefore, you're saying that if we elect a Republican president, we will increase the chances of a recession.
You're being more political than I try to be.
Forgive me.
But again, another lesson from financial crises. You know, the governments of the world haven't acquitted themselves very well in financial crises, and one mistake they make is they move too quickly to excessive austerity, excessive fiscal restraint before an economy is fully recovered. Mm-hmm. You know, unemployment's above 8%, long-term unemployment very, very high, and you know, things are very tough here today still. Our first obligation still is to heal the damage, repair the damage from the crisis. So we have to make sure we phase these fiscal reforms in more gradually.
We clearly have some bankers in the audience. I'll read three questions together for you to answer. Since nothing has really changed and too big to fail is an even larger threat, how soon do you see the next financial catastrophe happening in the United States? The second version of this is, do you believe...
It doesn't sound like a banker.
Well, there's someone who loves them. Do you believe that we would have had as severe a financial collapse if Glass-Steagall had not been overturned? And are the regulations in place sufficient to prevent a repeat? And lastly, should the Glass-Steagall Act be reinstalled? You're right. These are people who pay attention to bankers, not bankers themselves. Would never suggest that. Yeah.
Okay. I do not believe that the repeal of Glass-Steagall played a material role in the causes of our financial crisis. I know that view is not widely accepted in many places, and it takes some time to explain, but I'll just give you a couple quick examples. Our crisis was caused by something very different. We had a mix of a huge amount of risk built up outside our banking system, outside the safeguards and protections we put in place in the Great Depression. And that risk and leverage grew up, built up very substantially, and when the storm hit, put enormous pressure on a part of the system that provided about half the credit to the American economy. Nothing to do with Glass-Steagall, very, very damaging. We also had a set of safeguards on banks that were just not conservative enough. So banks, classic community banks, commercial banks, large banks, small banks, just took too much risk on the expectation the economy would still grow, house prices would never decline. And it was the combination of those two mistakes that made the crisis so damaging. Now, someone raised this question about too big to fail, and so let me say some things about that. It is true that we still have very large banks, slightly larger than before the crisis. Even though we have an economy of 7,000 banks, the large banks have a substantial share, market share in the U.S. economy. But put it in perspective, our banking system is still smaller and much less concentrated than the financial system of any other major economy. Smaller and less concentrated than Canada's, not just those of Europe that are still under so much pressure. And we've forced our banks to hold much, much more capital against risk, dramatically more capital against risk than they had before the crisis. That's the most valuable protection you can put in place against future financial crises. And these financial reforms give us the tools to break up, to dismember large institutions that make mistakes in the future without the taxpayer being on the hook to pay for those bailouts. These are very powerful reforms. They put us in a much stronger position. We're facing a lot of opposition to them, as you can see, from Republicans in particular, trying to unravel them, which we're fighting and resisting. And I'm very confident we're going to successfully resist.
I'm sorry, you said you are confident?
Very confident we're going to successfully resist. But it is a mistake to look at our system today and be concerned just because we have large banks still that our system is more vulnerable than it was before the crisis. Our system is much stronger than it was before the crisis, much stronger in terms of the level of capital in the system. Weakest parts of the system have basically been crushed and destroyed, and the reforms are very tough, and they will endure.
Given accepting that's a fact, that wouldn't negate the possibility that a Wells Fargo or a B of A or a Citi are in fact too big to fail. Can you state with confidence that they are not too big to fail?
Well, again, I think that they're by forcing them to run with less leverage, much more capital, it's much less likely that their mistakes would cause material damage to the broader financial system, to the economy as a whole. But if in the future they mismanage themselves to the point where they can't operate without government assistance, we do not have the capacity now and will not act to save them for their mistakes. If we have to act, we'll act so that we dismember them in a way they can be unwound safely with less collateral damage.
How important is American manufacturing ability and growing employment in that segment?
In manufacturing?
In manufacturing specifically, yeah.
Really quite promising and very important. You know, I think a lot of Americans worry that as a country we've lost the capacity to build things. We don't build real things anymore. And it's really not true. You know, we're still the dominant manufacturing power in the world, by many ways the most productive. And if you look at the early years of recovery in the United States, you should find reassuring and encouraging the fact that manufacturing has come back so strong. It's not just autos, where, of course, the successful restructuring of the automobile industry has been, you know, very, very, very powerful as a source of employment and strength. But across the manufacturing industry, you know, I was in Portland yesterday visiting Oregon Iron Works, which is another example, but there are examples all across the country of an important revival in manufacturing. One thing that's helping it, as I said, is people look ahead now and they see the competitive playing field shifting more in favor of American investment, American manufacturing. We want to reinforce that.
We're essentially in our lifetimes, as we've been through this once before, right? We were going to be a nation of burger flippers and we weren't. You're saying that we're having a period like that again?
People worry about that, but again, what's I know it's a dark moment still and people still feel the scars of the crisis, but if you look at what's happening across the American economy, what's uniquely good about and important about the United States is how broad-based our strength is. You know, it's not just in agriculture and energy or in high tech or even in finance. It's in basic manufacturing. And there are areas there where you're seeing American companies at the frontier of innovation, not just in high tech. And that's a very encouraging, remarkable thing.
Speaking of dark moments, a question from the audience. I'll read it in its entirety. Just how scary were the first few weeks of this administration? Tell the truth.
They were very scary. I mean, the fall of 08, you know, we were on the edge of a broad-based classic run on the financial system, the most dangerous thing that ever happened to economies. And President Bush and my predecessor, Henry Paulson, to their enormous credit, went to Congress and got authority they didn't have, and they acted with the FDIC and with the New York Fed to break the back of that initial panic. But when the president came into office in early 09, remember, the economy at that point was falling, as I said, at an annual rate of about 9%, and the momentum of the crisis was still gathering. The financial sector was still completely frozen. You couldn't raise capital. People thought house prices would fall 30% more from that level. So it was a gravely dangerous moment for the American economy, and it was happening all around the world, not just in the United States. So yes, it was a dark and scary moment. But as I said, the president, you know, he did not sit there and, you know, ask for a bunch of studies and wait for Republicans to join him, or he didn't try to play politics with the crisis. He was very tough and very courageous and did the hard things early on, and we're in a much better position for, and we've come a long way from that moment.
One thing that the person asking this question in the audience might be trying to get at is, given your position, how did it feel personally to be the Treasury Secretary at a time when everything could go wrong?
Well, you know, it was not my idea to come to the Treasury that moment. And I spend my life in public service, mostly watching other countries mismanage their financial crises. And that was somewhat scary training for what we face in the United States.
But potentially apt training.
Very, very useful training. I think that the hardest things, and I'm sure you all feel this way too, the hardest thing is deciding what is the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And then trying to make sure you can actually do it. And it was absolutely the case in parts of 08 when I was at the New York Fed and in the early parts of 09 where we were not confident that we were going to be able to put in place the set of things that would put out those financial fires. I remember meeting with the president in March of 09, and we met, you know, sometimes several times a day on these things. And I remember him saying to me at that time, I said, I want to know if you're confident this strategy is going to work. And I said, Mr. President, I'm not certain of anything in life, but I'm very confident that this strategy is better than all the alternatives available to us. And you saw in a remarkably short period of time the financial system stabilize, start to recover, economic growth return. Again, remember, the economy falling at an annual rate of 9% in the fourth quarter of 08. Economic growth started in the summer of 09. In 6 months, you went from 9% decline to about 2% growth, an incredibly quick, powerful turnaround. And that was all because of the things he did with the Fed in the Recovery Act, the global financial strategy, and the strategy we put in place to rescue the financial system. And, you know, as you've heard report, you know, people thought we were going to risk losing hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars in the financial rescue. Some people said trillions of dollars in the financial rescue. And these programs now are likely to provide a positive return to the American taxpayer. And an amazingly remarkable thing. Remember, the investments in banks, the most controversial, most loathed part of the financial rescue, are going to earn a positive return for the American taxpayer, about $20 billion, just those alone.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is U.S. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, who is sharing his thoughts on the state of the global economy ahead of the 2012 U.S.-China Strategic Economic Dialogue. Going back briefly to two other elements of the dark moments that our country faced, first of all, we still own, I think it's 27% of General Motors. Is that the correct figure?
We do. We have I'm not sure that's exactly the right figure, but we have substantial remaining equity stakes in a few companies and in a number of small banks, and we're going to move as quickly as we can to replace those with private capital and bring those back to the American taxpayer.
Can you give us a timeline of when we'll sell the GM stake?
Well, we started that process, and we're going to move as quickly as is prudent. What we want to do is balance two objectives. We want to get out as quickly as possible because it's not good for the economy, for the government to, you know, retain these investments longer than you need to. But we also want to maximize the return, minimize the risk of loss to the taxpayer. So we'll balance those objectives, and we're going to be able to continue to move along that path.
Housing cycles typically follow about a seven-year cycle, peak to trough, and then back up again. And most people believe the peak was in 2006, which would suggest that 2013 should be the bottom. Do you agree? Where are we in the housing cycle?
We've got some ways to go, and it's really very tough still. There's been some signs of little firmness in prices, demand for housing, in household construction. That's encouraging. But to be realistic, we've got a long ways to go, and it's very important that we continue to work to, help ease the damage, repair the damage. And what we're trying to do is make sure more Americans can refinance, even if they're underwater, to take advantage of lower interest rates. We're trying to take more of this huge stock of unoccupied real estate and put that into the rental market, where there's a lot of demand for rental property. And we want to make sure that more Americans can take advantage of modifications to lower the value, the cost of their mortgage payments, give them a better chance to stay in their house if they still have a job. And we're going to continue to do everything we can on front to make that possible.
You said a long ways a couple times, but can you quantify that?
Depends how strong how fast the economy grows. You know, the biggest determinant still about the pace of job creation, how quickly the unemployment comes down, and how quickly we repair the damage in the housing market is going to be how fast the economy grows. And again, that's why it's so important to remind people and remind politicians in Washington that we have to remain overwhelmingly focused on things that will strengthen economic growth.
forgive me for jumping around a little bit, but that's how the questions come in. What financial steps have been and can be done to isolate and strangle the Syrian regime?
A little outside my area, except for one thing, which is that we do have in place a very tough set of financial sanctions, and those are working with the broader pressure being brought by the international community on that government, not having enough impact yet, of course. But these financial sanctions are very tough, and we're going to keep tightening them.
In a similar vein, but with a bigger, more important country, do you anticipate the ongoing internal political crisis in China having any impact on your talks with the Chinese government?
Really, independent of this, these recent events in China, a lot of people looked at China, which is going through its own election, its own transition, political transition, have been concerned that that would stall and freeze the broader reform process. And it's hard to tell at this point how that turns out, but as I said in my remarks, they're doing two things now. They've done two things in the last few weeks and months, which I think are pretty encouraging. They widened the exchange rate band quite significantly, and that's a pretty strong signal of a commitment to letting the exchange rate become more market-determined. Very politically sensitive issue for China, but encouraging. And they've also started to pilot a set of financial reforms in one province in China. And that too signals, I think, a commitment to try to continue on these reform process. But I think ultimately, and this is true for the United States too, you're going to have to wait and see, wait till the end of the year to see how this transition shakes out in terms of the direction of reform.
What are your thoughts on what a carbon tax could do to help grow our green economy?
That's a dangerous question, not one I can shed some light on.
I would have thought the question about the Chinese leadership would have been more dangerous.
Taxes are much more dangerous politically for us. I'll answer it a different way. The tax reforms the president's laid out have two very simple important features. One is on the business side. We want to broaden the base, eliminate dozens of special preferences, loopholes, and use that money to bring down the corporate rate to a more sustainable level, not add to the future deficits, and preserve a set of very limited incentives to encourage research and development and investment in the U.S. and U.S. manufacturing. On the individual side, we think what tax reform has to do as we try to work to create a more simple, more fair system is we have to reduce some of the advantages we give the top 2% of Americans that are living with very, very low effective tax rates today. And so what the president's proposed is to let those Bush tax cuts for the top 2% expire on schedule, and then to go beyond that and reduce some of the additional advantages they enjoy through deductions and exclusions so that their effective tax burden rises moderately. That basic approach we think is going to have to guide any tax reform strategy going forward. And we think if we do that, you can raise the modest amounts of revenue we need to complement the spending savings and get our deficits down to the point where the debt's no longer growing as a share of the economy.
I guess what I'd like your reaction to play off of that question, there's a frustration in the community that pays attention to these sorts of things, that there's a disconnect. On the one hand, the president has a green jobs and a green economy agenda. On the other hand, all reasonable people in that world, both polluters and environmentalists, agree that a carbon tax would help solve the problem and raise a lot of revenue, but you're not talking about a carbon tax specifically.
Let me evade it a different way, which is the president has done a huge amount to put in place a better set of incentives for investment in clean energy and much tougher fuel economy standards. Just two examples of pretty material changes in the incentives for how we use energy in the United States and how to make sure we're improving our ability to rely on cleaner sources of energy in the future. Now, of course, we're in the middle of a huge boom in oil and gas, too. And the combined effect of those changes is going to make us less dependent on foreign sources of energy and over time allow us to rely more on clean energy sources.
We'll give you credit for a substantive evasion of mentioning the words carbon tax. We'll go very broad for a few minutes and then very narrow. Simpson-Bowles appeared to be a credible study. How can we function and solve problems if we continue to put off important decisions until, quote, after the election? This questioner adds, it's just math.
We don't want to, it's not our choice, our desire to wait until after the election. As you know, we spent a huge amount of time and political capital last year trying to build consensus on something very, very close to Simpson-Bowles. But we found that Congress was not ready. Republicans were not yet willing to put on the table, alongside the reforms on Medicare and Medicaid, we were proposing a set of tax reforms that would raise revenue, even modestly increase the burden of the top 2% of Americans. And so that's the reason why, faced with that experience and the failure of the supercommittee last year to reach consensus, that's why most people have come to the judgment that we're building towards a negotiation that's going to have to begin after the election. I wish it were different. But given every bipartisan proposal, not just Bowles-Simpson, let's look to this question, have reached the judgment the president has that to solve this in a way sensibly, economically, and politically, you have to have tax reform that raises a modest amount of revenues on a very limited number of Americans.
But is it wrong, and I think what is at the heart of this question, to assume that the president himself did not embrace Simpson-Bowles?
The president's proposal is very, very close to the basic framework of Simpson-Bowles, and that's where this debate is going to end. I'm very, very confident. There are a couple differences from what the president proposed for Simpson-Bowles. They asked for slightly more revenue, $2 trillion over 10 years. The president's proposal is $1.5 trillion. Simpson-Bowles has much deeper cuts on defense than the president believed was tenable for the nation to accept. We go deeper than Simpson-Bowles on some issues. We have about the same level of healthcare savings over the first 10 years, or the first 20 years in some context. So we're much closer than we are different in that context. And as I said, I think this debate is going to end with a framework of reforms very close to what was in Simpson-Bowles and very close to where the president is.
What is your biggest concern about the future of the U.S. economy and the global economy?
My biggest concern, and I think this should be the dominant concern of Americans, about whether this political system we have in this country, with the country so divided, is going to be able to start doing things, not just fighting about them. I think that's the biggest overwhelming risk to the American economy. No economy can be stronger than the capacity of its political system to do tough things. We have a great history as a country of governments willing to do hard things. You know, the choices we made in the United States to provide universal access to public education, the highway system, Medicare, Social Security, the world-class system we created for property rights enforcement, protect the innovator, those were things, decisions made by this political system in the past, and we have to make sure we recapture that fundamentally important strength.
You made reference earlier that actually there was a bipartisan response to the worst parts of the 2008-2009 crisis. Why were we able to approach that in a bipartisan way and not the debt ceiling nonsense, for example? My words, not yours, obviously.
It's an excellent point. In fact, you could say that that early stage of the financial rescue was the last bipartisan moment, and that the political costs of those actions were so divisive that it helped erode the center of gravity in the American political system, make it harder to do things going forward. But we're a very strong country, very resilient country, and we have tremendous resources, and we have a bit of time to solve these problems. We're not in the position where so many countries are that we have to try to solve in the next 8 months the problems of the next 100 years. Our problems are much more manageable problems. And these reforms we're debating about tax reform and title reform require relatively modest changes in how Americans live, not dramatic changes. There are things we can handle.
So on the one hand, you're concerned that our political divisiveness is the biggest threat that we face economically. On the other hand, you're confident in our ability to overcome those.
I try to be an optimist. It's important to be an optimist about this country. And again, if you look at, Americans are understandably worried about our country, but our challenges are much more manageable challenges than what countries face around the world today. I wouldn't trade our challenges for anybody else's. But, you cannot solve these things by just talking about them and debating them. You can only solve them by getting politicians in Washington to make some compromise, principled compromise.
And so in that vein, and we have reached the point in the program where we are almost out of time, first of all, would you ever consider running for public office?
No. Just to reassure everybody, there is no risk of that. Although I honor the people who do it, I think that public service is a noble, important thing, and we'd be better as a country if you have more people willing to spend some time doing that.
And lastly, do you have any interest in, and are you being considered for, the position of president of Dartmouth?
No.
So you are not being considered for it, as far as you know?
I certainly hope not.
Why wouldn't you be interested in being president of Dartmouth?
It's a complicated, great place, complicated question, though. But I do want to just end with just a bit of qualified optimism. You know, we've come a really long way since 2008. We're in a much stronger position as a country today. And even with our challenges we face still, and it's a very tough economy still, I think Americans should feel more confident than they've been any time in the last 3 or 4 or 5 years. And I think that confidence is justified.
Well, I think it's safe to say that this is an appreciative audience to Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner here in San Francisco. We also want to thank our audiences on radio, television, and the Internet. I'd like to remind everyone present to please stay seated until Secretary Geithner has left the room. I'm Adam Leshinsky, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.